Hello and welcome. Today we'll be discussing key research findings on search engine marketing. My name is Pauline Jacober, Director of Marketing at HighRankings, a search engine optimization agency. I am joined by Tim McAddy, Senior Analyst at Marketing Sherpa, and Jill Whalen, CEO of HighRankings, who will be speaking on the key findings from the 2009 Search Marketing Benchmark Guide. And now I'll hand it over to Tim and Jill. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I'd like to direct you to slide two. We're going to tell you a little bit about where our data comes from. We have over 50 sources of best of and partnered data. We did a survey of 1,928 Sherpa search marketers. We have eye tracking charts looking at the effects on search users of personalization of search results. We look at how Chinese search differs, including Google versus Baidu, and multiple branding studies showing that unclicked search inventory, if used correctly, can positively affect brand metrics. Additionally, we have lots of real-life examples submitted by marketers that can help anyone improve their search marketing. If you'll now go to slide three, we're going to move along into the business of search. We'll be covering budgets, how budgets affect search strategy, and how hiring and retention of search marketers is becoming a little less of a hassle these days. On slide four, we'll be looking at budget elasticity. According to a survey of nearly 2,000 search marketers in May of 2008, almost half report that they have two small budgets that are used up early in the month, leaving the account dark for the remainder of the month. What many marketers have done to combat this problem is to dictate levels of efficiency that must be met rather than levels of budget that must be spent. The budget itself is elastic and expands or contracts depending on the volume available at the efficiency level desired. So, Jill, I'd like to ask you, what have you seen just with your clients in terms of budgeting?
We definitely see budget can be a problem with search marketing. That, you know, it seems that a lot of companies just haven't quite understood the costs involved in it, especially with organic SEO. I know this slide is I think more for paid search, but it seems to happen in both paid and organic search where they just don't quite understand that this is an expensive endeavor.
Okay. Let's move on to slide five. One of the things that we're seeing here is there is definitely a huge difference between the paid search and the organic search amounts that are going out, and that while these are all on the rise, it definitely seems like everything's going up, but that this ratio of paid to organic is staying about the same. How do you feel about spending on organic? Where should people really be putting their money?
Yeah, I think this is really interesting because, as I think some of the future slides show in this presentation, that the organic gets so many more clicks than the paid that it's interesting that they're still not willing to put the money into organic that they will put into paid. And we see that all the time. You know, clients come to us or potential clients and they'll say, yeah, they're spending $10,000 or $20,000 a month on paid search, and they don't want to spend even, say, $3,000 a month on organic search when the results for the long term could be so much better for them. They're just not getting it. I think more and more people are starting to get it, but it's not there yet.
Do you think that's just an issue of metrics, just people aren't paying attention to the ROI of it, or is it just kind of a knee-jerk reaction where, you know, when you're spending a lot of money on media, you pay more attention to that because there's money going out?
I think perhaps it's still a misunderstanding about organic search that a lot of marketers still don't understand it. They get paid, you know, they understand advertising, you buy an ad, you get your clicks. You know, it's much more traditional to them. They get that. But SEO is kind of like this mystical thing still, sort of like PR, you know, and publicity. When you're paying for that, you don't really know what you're getting all the time. And I think there's still often companies are still kind of scared of it and need to be more educated about it. I think that will really help. And, you know, my hope is that next year's numbers here will be a little higher for the organic spends.
Yeah, me too. Well, let's move to six here, kind of staying in the same vein. One of the questions we asked was whether viral is actually making it into the budget. And things like, you know, SEO, viral, PR tend to get sort of lumped in together. And what we found was that 22% of our respondents we're actually putting money behind viral, which, I mean, I suppose is okay. It's a good thing that 22%, but that still leaves a whole lot of people that aren't. I mean, in terms of just, you know, spending on PR, on time spent, on creative, it certainly seems to me like there's a lot of money that can be spent efficiently there that's not yet.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think now that social media is becoming a little bit more widespread and well-known, you know, that's a great way to spread viral ideas and things. So, I think that will start to go up as well. People, everyone hears about social media and thinks they need to get into it, whether or not that's true. I think more and more will be experimenting with it. And, again, I don't know if they'll put the budget towards it because it's a little mystical as well, but we may see those numbers go up as well.
Do you have any tips for someone who's putting out, say, a viral video? What can they do to make their SEO better?
Well, for videos, I mean, you definitely want to make sure they're up on YouTube because Google seems to want to show YouTube stuff first, even though they deny it, but since they own YouTube.
Yeah, no self-interest there.
Yeah, they definitely seem to show it first. They do say that it's because there's just so much volume there that YouTube does tend to go up to the top, which could be true. And then it's really optimizing videos is kind of your old-fashioned SEO. Make sure that the title of the video has keywords in it, and I think you can even add meta tags and things like that, but there's not a whole lot you can do because the engines can't index the content. I do think they're working on things like that, though, so that will be an interesting space. And, another thing you can do, which is more work, is transcribe the video so you actually do have content that could go along with the video, or at least a summary that you put up with it. That could really help it get found in the search engines.
What about, I know a lot of videos have closed captioning. Does that sort of get picked up as metadata?
I'm actually not sure about that.
That would be kind of interesting to find out.
Yeah, you can look into that.
Yeah. All right, so let's move on to slide 7. Just asking, year over year, how hard it is to keep and retain, to get and retain SEM staff and talent. We were seeing just a slight easing of this staffing crunch for SEM. So it does indicate that while it's still definitely difficult to get, high quality people, that just the industry itself is maturing and growing and there's just more people out there to do the jobs. So if you're looking for someone, have hope. It does look like it's going to get a little better before long.
Yeah, and this does make sense to me as well, just because the industry has been around now for about 14, 15 years. And so now there are more people who have had jobs in this. It's still not a lot, and there's really no college courses to speak of, or at least no majors in it. So there's that problem still. But at least people have heard of it, and kids in college have heard of it, and are getting jobs in this area, which is great. And these numbers will definitely go up too next year, I'm sure.
Yeah, I actually, I did some recruiting down in Texas, the University of Austin there, they have a pretty cool media program, and they are actually offering some search classes, including SEO now, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's really good because you don't see it much, and I worry that some of the programs that are being offered are probably kind of outdated because I don't know too many search marketers who are going to give up their day job to become professors. So who's
yeah.
Teaching these classes, it's a little worrisome.
there's definitely probably not as much money to be made there. So let's move on to slide 8. So we're going to look at tactical issues in search. In this chapter, we'll look at keyword phrase length, where clicks are coming from, how to get the best clickers using targeting, and issues in making sense of it all using tracking and analytics. On slide 9, looking at sort of a definition here of defining our long tail. So we're looking at this curve here of of search phrases and how long phrases are that searchers are actually using. This has implications on both sides for paid search and SEO. But I think kind of the interesting thing is just thinking about, you know, what really is the long term or long tail, excuse me. And I think what we're finding here is that this stretch of words from sort of 4-word phrases out to about 7 words really seems like the mid tail, which we think is kind of the sweet spot where there might not be as much volume, you know, per phrase, but what we've seen elsewhere is that those longish terms tend to convert a lot better, and they're just much more efficient. Longer than that, and Google tends to sort of, I guess, ding you for quality score issues because of low volume and low click rates. But shorter than that, it tends to get a little bit less efficient. So what's your thoughts on sort of incorporating you know, these longer phrases into your SEO strategy?
Yeah, for long tail, and I kind of consider long tail probably the 4-word keywords and longer. Used to be 3. I mean, it could still be considered the 3-word ones if it's not too competitive of a market. But you know, in some competitive markets, even a 3-word phrase it can be highly competitive. So, you know, what I think is that the shorter tail words, let's say, you know, 1 to 3 word phrases, can be so competitive that they're going to be tricky to get in your SEO. That doesn't mean you shouldn't optimize for them. You definitely should. I mean, not a 1-word keyword. I don't typically believe in that too much for most clients. But, you know, the 2 words and 3 words, for sure, some of those are going to be your best words. But the longer ones, they're going to be a lot easier to get and gain traffic from, to get good rankings with, because they're less competitive. And the good thing about them is sometimes it's just a question of writing articles or blog posts that are just naturally using those words. You don't have to do a full-out SEO campaign to get some of these longer-tail words. Just put out a lot of content that's naturally using phrases, and you'll find that you get a lot of traffic, and it adds up. You know, each phrase may only get one hit a week, but it adds up to a lot of traffic over time if you have a lot of content. And like you said, it converts better, too, because it can be very specific, and your site is exactly what the searcher is looking for.
Okay. And I've seen some PR documents that went out that were just really saturated with, you know, long-tail keywords and lots of synonyms and you know, very obviously designed to attract searchers. At what point do you think, you know, it's sort of more important to be searchable versus readable for those PR documents?
It's always more important to be readable for any document, and I'm not a big fan of SEO'd press releases. I think they really don't get you too far. They may, if you know, if people have a Google alert set for a certain phrase, they may, you know, they'll end up seeing that press release or at least seeing the search results with it. But they're not, you know, it's silly to just stuff keyword phrases in a press release or on your website pages, in your articles or blog posts. You don't need to stuff them. You need to write naturally and just keep the words in mind that people are searching for and, you know, use them where it makes sense to do so.
Okay. I'm glad I'm not alone in thinking that looks silly.
Yes.
All right. Let's move on to slide 10. Well, this was a slide that what we're looking here is we're looking at everyone versus business decision makers, and we're looking at actual clicks and the percentage broken out between paid and natural clicks, and then within that, broken out by the top 3 search engines, Google, Yahoo, and MSN. And I constructed this, you know, to a certain extent for dramatic effect, just because in the search world, so much attention is given to paid search, and yet when you look at this broken out, the proportion of paid clicks versus natural clicks is really very small, and it doesn't vary a ton between sort of the general population and business decision makers. And if anything, you know, business decision makers tend to click slightly less on just a straight up ratio on Google here we're seeing. So I mean the point I guess is just that SEO really is incredibly important.
Yeah, and totally, and that's what we talked about a little bit earlier, and that's why it kind of makes me laugh when clients don't want to spend on the organic and instead spend on the paid where it's not getting as many clicks. But I think also, perhaps the chart skewed a little because so many people search for information as opposed to for buying products, and so typically the ads are going to be for products and services rather than information. So perhaps a lot of those clicks that we see there, it'd be maybe another interesting test to see how many of those are actually searching for information and wouldn't have any need to click on an ad.
Right. Well, and I mean, when you think about how many billions of searches there are, 5.7% of, a billion searches, that's a lot of clicks. there's obviously still a huge market out there, but
yeah.
But man, is it important to definitely consider SEO first.
And I do know when I'm searching for to actually buy a product or service, which is rare. Most of my searches are not that. Those are the few times where I do click the ads. While some people are distrustful still of ads, I think less and less, especially with Google, because their ads do tend to be fairly relevant to what the search term was.
Right, and that's definitely something I want to get into in a little bit when we look at the branding effect of search ads. So hold that thought.
Okay.
Let's move on to slide 11. So just really quick, we're looking at the importance of targeting for efficiency. And search, like any other medium, you do want to try and clean out as much wasted inventory as possible from your overall campaign. And in terms of paid search, geo-targeting, behavioral targeting, contextual targeting, demographic targeting, these are definitely all good ways of increasing your ROI just by removing people from the click pool that you might not necessarily want in there. We've also seen that, especially with geo-targeting, you do sometimes pay a premium for those clicks. So it is important to actually do the math and figure out, if I'm paying more per a geo-targeted click versus doing a national campaign, or I'm paying less but getting more wasted impressions, where does that break out? So that is something that's going to vary, I think, on an advertiser-by-advertiser basis and a phrase-by-phrase basis, but it's still extremely important.
Yeah, and it's possible that people still aren't familiar with all the various things they can do with their paid search campaigns as well. They're always adding new features, and sometimes companies just set up their campaigns and let them run.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to slide 12. This was where we put out the question, just we actually gave them all these choices and said, what are your biggest challenges right now? And what we got back was that tracking offline conversions and increasing competition for natural search rankings, as well as increased competition for paid search rankings, we're definitely at the top of the list. It's both sort of figuring out what happened after the fact and how valuable the click is, as well as just getting on the page in the first place for natural search.
Yeah, these are definite challenges that we see as well. Tracking offline conversions is really difficult. If you're the type of business like a manufacturer that you're not actually selling a product, but you want to direct people to your dealers or they're supposed to call you, it's tough. There's some new software out there that you can get special phone numbers that can be tracked, and things like that help. And the increased competition for natural search rankings, it's completely different than when I was first doing SEO back in the 90s, where, pretty much anything you wanted to optimize for, you optimized, and there you were at the top of the page. But these days, the challenge what good SEOs really need to do is find those gems of keyword phrases that aren't super highly competitive, but still bring them traffic. And I think that's, you know, it's not quite the long tail ones, but those ones that do bring a lot of traffic, and that's hard. And I'm sure in the paid, it's the same. It's just as competitive, if not worse, because then you're paying for every single click too.
Yeah. Well, for someone who's, you know, trying to invest capital into SEO and trying to prove that, you know, that SEO is actually bringing in business, you know, and actually wrapping that back to a conversion, either, you know, on or offline. I mean, what do you think are sort of the best ways to go about doing that?
To prove that it's worthwhile, it's tricky because a lot of times these days for good SEO, there's not like anything you can just do quickly and test it. There may be some low-hanging fruit for some websites, but oftentimes it's kind of a major overhaul, unfortunately, which is another reason I think that companies don't want to spend for it. But, you know, you could at least find some of that low-hanging fruit and fix up those kinds of things on the website. And when you see that that helps, you know, or the client sees that that helps or the company sees, they might be willing to then do a little bit more, you know, maybe do a certain section of the website. If you have a really huge website, it's going to be a big undertaking to try to do the whole thing, but do it section by section. And I think when companies start to see results, they get on board, and that, you know, that's really the only way you can do it if they're not sure what they want to do.
Okay. Let's move on here then to slide 13. So looking here at conversion and ROI coming up as the most underused metrics. Now, unlike the last slide where we actually, you know, gave them choices, in this slide we just left it open-ended and you know, unbidden, asked people what they thought the most underused metrics were in search marketing, and then went through and manually hand-coded all these things. And again, you know, I mean, conversion, ROI, lifetime visitor value, latent conversions, these things are definitely top of mind, which I think is kind of ironic when we get into the analytics slides a little bit later on. But the point being that, you know, I think search marketers are really trying to get away from this sort of cost-per-click mentality of getting people on the site and then you know, forgetting about them to sort of a more closed loop marketing approach.
Yeah, and the you know, conversions and ROI are really definitely the most important thing. It's in the years past we didn't have the good analytics tools that we have now, and it was difficult to measure that stuff. So instead, you know, we would just measure rankings and things that may not actually matter, because you might be ranking for phrases no one's searching for, so that doesn't do you much good. But if you can actually measure not only the traffic but the conversions and how much you're making per visitor and all that, you have to do that. I mean, you're kind of crazy not to, but it is surprising how many just aren't doing it. And I think part of that is it's more difficult to set up and you know, or they just lack the manpower. Sometimes companies we see, they just, you know, they throw somebody on the task of analytics when they already have 50 other, you know, they wear 50 other hats. They don't have people that are dedicated to this kind of thing.
Yeah, it's definitely tough. Let's move on to analytics then. So slide 14, looking at the growth of Google Analytics year over year, and seeing some you know, in a way I am very happy about this. I think it's great that search marketers are, you know, have this great free tool that they're using, you know, and it's a very cool thing. On the other hand, you're seeing, you know, services like Web Trends dropping off, and there is sort of this move away from hosted analytics to do-it-yourself analytics. And with that, you know, I mean, you know, as you were saying, it's just people aren't really staffing for it, and I'm just it worries me that people, you know, aren't really going to to take full advantage of this tool.
Yeah, and that's what's really great about Google Analytics is that it is free. There's no excuse anymore for not measuring what matters. And Google Analytics, I mean, I love it. It's awesome. It does anything that most of the expensive tools do. I haven't really seen much it doesn't do. You know, when some people say, well, it doesn't do this or it doesn't do that, you know, if you know the tool, it usually does. You may have to dig for it a little bit, but you may forget how you did it one time to the next. But Google Analytics is definitely a powerful, powerful tool, and there's no excuse for not using it if you don't have a budget. And even if you do, I mean, we're typically using it for most of our clients these days. That most of them actually come to us already with it, which is interesting as well. And now, you know, I don't know if you've heard, but just recently over the last few weeks, they've added some new features to it as well. They haven't been enabled yet in my account when last time I checked, but I'm looking forward to playing with those because you're going to be able to do all kinds of new customized reports that you can save. And you know, they're just making it better and better. So while I feel bad for Omniture and WebTrends and ClickTrax, you know, they probably need to get into a new business, I think.
Well, do you think there's really the, you know, sort of analytical consulting, you know, firepower out there to sort of fill the void and make sure that Google Analytics is being used appropriately?
Definitely, yeah. As a service, I think more companies will be doing that because, like I said before, they don't have the people on the teams, and it is a specialized thing. You know, once you do get to know it a bit, it's not too difficult. And so, whether you maybe consultants train someone in-house or just do the analytics for the company, I think we'll see that more often. We do stuff like that now with some clients where, you know, each month we basically just go through the analytics and pull out the stuff that we think is interesting to them. They don't need to look at all the cool stuff that we do, but, you know, pull out the major bits, and we know where to find them, and then make our recommendations based on that, and that works out as a great service. I think a lot of both paid and organic companies are doing that, and more will be in the future.
Okay. Out of curiosity, what do you think kind of the coolest reports and best information you can get out of Google Analytics is?
Well, there's so much. It really depends on what you're doing. For our purposes, we tend to look at the keywords, you know, so we go straight to the keyword section and what keywords have pulled in traffic to the site and then what happens, are they converting or not? So that's our most important aspect. But you know, on the other hand, there's other stuff that's all cool too, like referring sites is always interesting, especially if you're doing social media. You can see, you know, where you're getting links from and who's talking about you. There's, you know, I don't know, there's some, everything's good about it. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, I'm just kind of a tangent here, but I don't know if you've ever heard of the site Quantcast.
I've heard of it.
Yeah, Quantcast. It's a really interesting site. It's very easy to just throw some tags onto your pages, similar to Google Analytics, and then they run a whole host of just metrics and see who's coming to your site, and it's, you know, panel-based measurement. And they also show sort of where your visitors are also going.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of like a, you know, census level comm score that you have control over. So just very cool stuff, and, you know, a lot of democratization of these tools going on right now that's really interesting.
Do they have a free tool or is that a paid?
Yes, it's I believe there's a free and a paid option, but the free is quite powerful.
Yeah, we'll look into that too.
Cool. So next slide. 15. Again, we are definitely seeing, you know, some differences here in what people are looking for based on their budget levels. And I think it's really interesting here that if you know, so this was a 1 to 6 ranking, you know, 1 being what was it? 1 most important, 6 least important, you know, and for everyone, accuracy came up on top. But when you looked at ease of implementation, ability to handle complexity, and price, you're seeing some, you know, some differences there between our two budget levels that we split it out by. And I think it's really fascinating that, you know, ability to handle complexity is less important for those under 10,000 SEM budget people, and ease of implementation is a little bit less important for the 25K and above SEM budget folks. And it really does just, I think, just illustrate what we were talking about earlier.
Right. I think that does definitely, you know, the fact that they just don't have someone, if it's, you know, they don't care if it's going to handle complexity because they got nobody to figure all that out anyway.
Yeah. And one thing I'm really looking forward to the day when that last one down there, you know, ability to integrate with offline media starts creeping the other direction, because that'll mean, I think, that search has really, you know, entered into marketing as a mature, you know, piece of the whole pie.
Yeah, true.
All right, well, let's get on here to Search Expands. And if you go to slide 17, this was just a really, really cool study. We work with Enquiro, a fair amount, very cool company out of Canada. And what they did was they actually surveyed users of search engines, both on generic keyword queries and branded keyword queries for a cell phone. They did a few other products as well. This is just the one we chose to highlight. And what we're looking at here is when respondents were asked whether they liked this whole battery of brands, the test brand saw some pretty massive increases in a control versus a search ad exposed group. So what we're seeing here is that the biggest increases there are when you have the top organic spot, especially in that branded keyword query, or a combination of the top side and top organic. But the point being that anytime you had this combination of, you know, a brand coming up both in an organic spot and in a paid spot, it just really reinforced the fact, you know, in these people's minds that the brand sort of deserved to be there and that it could be trusted and even liked, and, you know, that all leads to purchase intent and so on and so forth. And it's just a really fascinating study. So,
yeah, that's interesting. I have heard that through the years as well. I don't know if it was anecdotal or if there were other studies done on it as well. It's interesting because when PPC first came out with Google AdWords, and I tried it out just for myself, and I thought, oh, this is cool. I can just have all these free ads out there, and people will see my name and stuff, and I don't even have to pay unless they click on it, which basically is just branding. But a lot of people never even thought of it that way, and it's a little trickier to use it that way today because they'll remove your ads, I think, if you're not getting clicks. But it is definitely it's a branding thing. If someone searches for your brand and your competitors are over there in the ads and you're not, that's probably not a good thing for you.
Well, I mean, I remember, you know, just when Dynamic Logic was getting started, they had, you know, their whole campaign was, you know, only 1% of your ads are getting clicked on. You know, what happens to the other 99%? You know, and that was when click-through rates were actually still 1%. And that was for display ads. So the fact that, you know, marketers are just now coming around to this for search, it does show, I think, sort of a divide in how people think about advertising in terms of branding versus direct response. And it does definitely show that, you know, direct response folks got put in charge of search in a lot of companies, and there does need to be some education, I think, you know, both ways in terms of how response versus branding can work in tandem.
Yeah, and it's funny because those same companies would probably spend, you know, millions on billboards and things that you can't measure, you know, magazine ads or something, but not on a paid search ad because they just wouldn't get it or don't see it as the same thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, do you have any sort of advice for, like, I guess, putting the right copy out there to drive SEO using paid search? Or
drive
organic?
SEO using paid search?
Or to drive organic clicks using your paid search ads?
Well, I think nothing more than sort of what you just said, just, you know, being there, too, and that reinforces the brand, just to see both ads, you know, both organic and paid being there, and you know, using your company name in the title and that sort of thing can certainly help. And your you know, your tagline should probably be in the ad. You see that a lot with new campaigns. Like, they'll do television campaigns and they may mention a certain phrase or something like that. Those are the kinds of things, too, you want to bid on, because people will remember that catchphrase and they may go searching for you, and you certainly don't want your competitors showing up there. Actually, as a side note, that just reminded me, when McCain had the debate, one of the debates, and he was talking about Joe the Plumber, I had my son go look on Google to see if the McCain campaign had ad for Joe the Plumber, because he mentioned it like 100 times, and it just made me think it was like a keyword phrase. And no, there was no ads there. But the next day, Obama did have an ad there, not McCain. And I, you know, I thought, well, lost opportunity for McCain.
Oh, big lost opportunity. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And he may have subsequently bought it later, but I didn't check again.
No, that's really funny. All right, well, let's move on here to slide 18. So what we're looking at here is, according to Nielsen, there are 46 million Americans performing searches from their mobile device, and that number is rapidly increasing thanks to faster mobile data networks and the massive influx of smartphones into the marketplace. So looking just at the usage frequency of mobile search among Google's mobile search users, we're seeing that WAP gets far more searches per searcher than do the other methods. And I think the implication is that you know, as the mobile internet simply turns into the internet, mobile search really is going to become the norm. So sort of what that means for searchers is you sort of need to start incorporating this whole, you know, geo level of search targeting into your SEO and PPC.
Yeah, local search definitely is big with mobile. And obviously, if you're a local company, you know, a restaurant or anything like that, you need to be doing that. But even for anything, I think it also means you need to have a mobile-friendly site if you can, so that it at least looks decent on a mobile browser. You know, I mean, it's so cool to have your mobile. I have an iPhone now, and you know, anytime I just, you know, can be anywhere, out at a restaurant or any place, and just think of something you want to go search for, and you can, and that's, I think, I'm sure why these numbers are increasing. You have the internet in your pocket, basically.
Yeah, it was interesting. I was actually shopping for a phone the other day, and I saw a phone that had a Google 411 button just built right into it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it was, yeah. I mean, definitely some collision there with the handset makers. But interesting stuff.
Yep.
All right, and our last slide here. I think for everybody, international search is something that should be on the radar. You know, if not from the point of selling more to other countries, at least, you know, making sure that you're excluding them if you can only sell in this country, or, you know, I mean, but at least sort of putting it into the plan and on some level. And just a very specific example of sort of the kind of stuff that's out there. And again, these aren't full results. This is just a highlight from another study that Inquirer did, where we were looking at the way Chinese language searchers search. Inquirer exposed them to a Google US page, Google China page, and then a Baidu page. And Baidu, if you're not familiar with it, is the biggest search engine in China. It's one of the only countries where, you know, Google isn't at the top of the pack. In part because the Chinese government actually shut them down for a while. But the kind of interesting thing that pops out from this image is what you're looking at is clicks and eyeball fixations from an eye tracking study, and you're seeing that sort of what we take for granted, which is this golden triangle of the top left corner sort of moving down and over, being the standard, that once you get into different alphabets and then over into Baidu with sort of different mind frames for searching, that the search patterns and search activities do really radically alter. So if you are getting into Chinese search, which again is huge, or any other language, it does pay to sort of do your homework first and figure out how to really take advantage of that on your searcher's terms, not on your own.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I wonder if any of the effect is that perhaps Baidu's results might not be quite as relevant as Google's. And so, you kind of have to scan the whole page, where with Google you might trust more that those top ones are probably going to have what I need because they tend to be good. It could be another reason for that scanning as well.
Yeah, that's exactly correct, actually. Baidu mixes in a lot of ads in with the natural rankings. You do have paid ads on the right. You also have a lot of paid ads mixed in. So I think users are understandably a little bit more skeptical.
Yeah, so they're trying to figure out what they're seeing here, and they don't know where to click.
Yeah. But do you have anything closing here that you'd like to talk about?
No, I think we pretty much covered everything here. It was a fun thing to do, and interesting slides here, and the book itself. I've also browsed through all the other interesting graphs and charts you have, and there's so much more to this stuff than just these 20 or so that we've shown. So it's definitely a highly recommended book for anyone who's interested in this kind of information.
Well, thank you very much, and appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you, Tim.
So, Pauline, I guess it's all yours. Thanks, everyone.
Great. This concludes our webinar. Feel free to post any questions you have. The High Rankings Advisor will address and answer some of your questions in the November 19th issue. In addition, Marketing Sherpa has provided a generous $100 discount on the Search Marketing Benchmark Guide. We'll be sending you a follow-up email shortly with this information. Thanks again.